Good morning, and welcome to Coastal Conversations here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. From fisheries to tourism, from energy to environment, from economy to ecology, we go beyond the social media soundbites, probing deeply into complex issues and solutions. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant, in partnership with Scudic Institute and the First Coast. I'm Galen Koch, host and producer of Island Institute's podcast, From the Sea Up. This week on Coastal Conversations, we're featuring an episode from Season 3 of From the Sea Up, and we're talking all about the innovation that's happening in Maine's marine industries and the blue economy. In this episode, we're looking at how Maine communities and working waterfronts are transitioning away from fossil fuels towards energy solutions that are better for the environment and more cost-effective. You're listening to From the Sea Up, a podcast from the Island Institute. I'm Galen Koch.
So where are we going here?
I'll just take you down the end of the road, and you can look at the other end of the island, and then we'll go head back towards the co-op. I'm getting ready to load another load on my trailer this afternoon.
I'm riding around in the car with Bruce Fernald.
Lobster fisherman for 50 years, was born here, and will be 73 in August, and here I am.
Bruce lives on Little Cranberry, or Islesford, as some call it. This island is a 35-minute boat ride from Mount Desert Island.
Well, the island is about a mile and a half long, a mile wide. There's probably about 150 houses on it, various businesses from co-op to a restaurant dock to carpenters and caretakers, artists, and a few people that work from home on various jobs. And there's about 70 people maybe in the wintertime, and it goes up to 250 or 300 in the summer. And it's peaceful. Not so much in the summer, but the rest of the year is just the way we like it. Peace and quiet and just low-key.
Bruce and his wife, Barb, raised their children here on Little Cranberry. And Bruce's family goes way back.
That's my brother there.
Oh!
My youngest brother.
Oh my goodness. Just running into each other at the post office.
Oh yeah. You know what?
He's like, there's Bruce again on the television.
Nobody bats an eye. Bruce has got
That's my mother's house there. That's where I grew up. That's my brother's house, one of them here. My niece's house, and that's my sister Karen's house there.
So there's 70 people on the island. How many are you related to?
Probably if all my siblings are here, which they're not all the time, but there would be, I don't know, 15.
Wow. High percentage.
That's my other brother's house, Mark's.
Islesford resembles a lot of Maine's outer islands. It has a population that fluctuates with the seasons, multi-generational year-round families, and a community of artists and fishermen. But when you arrive on this island, you may notice something different about Islesford's waterfront. The roof of the Lobster Co-op, a classic wooden structure on a long wharf, is completely covered in solar panels. In this season of Island Institute's podcast, From the Sea Up, we're talking about innovation and bringing you stories about the innovation that's happening in Maine's marine industries and the blue economy. In this episode, we're looking at how Maine communities and working waterfronts are transitioning away from fossil fuels towards energy solutions that are better for the environment and more cost-effective. From electric boats to solar energy, these transitions will make Maine's coastal towns and islands more resilient, but access to these kinds of energy solutions is still limited. There are hurdles that the state, utility companies, and individual communities need to overcome. And the problems require flexible, collaborative solutions. To understand some of those hurdles, it's helpful to understand how energy even gets to a place like Islesford, an island that's 3 miles out to sea.
See, my father was born I think, in 28. So electricity, I think, was already here when he was born. Not long before that is when they laid the cables.
Electricity reaches Little Cranberry underwater in a big cable that stretches from Great Cranberry Island.
It goes from Mount Desert Island and from Mansett to the west side of Big Cranberry. And then it goes, you know, crosses the island, power lines. And then the cable connects at the closest point between Big Cranberry and Little Cranberry on our southwestern corner of the island. And the cable's about a third of a mile long. And actually, it was just replaced a couple of years ago because it was 50 years old.
This cable is what's called subsea, which means, maybe obviously, that it's buried under the ocean floor. And it carries all of Little Cranberry's electricity. But there are limitations to what this infrastructure can support.
We don't have three-phase power here.
You don't have three-phase power. No. How does that work with
I you? Don't. I mean, we had, I guess they had to put in extra transformers down to the co-op and the Islesford Dock because of the usage. So they can, I mean, electricity to me is, when it comes to that, is I just start scratching my head.
If you're not an electrician or if you don't work for a utility company, electricity is confusing. Three-phase power always has me scratching my head, too. So what exactly is it? Well, the phase part refers to the timing of the electricity. Instead of sending electricity in one current, or phase, three-phase power sends it over in three, spacing out the timing the power arrives at a building. Think of it like waves hitting the shore. If the energy of three waves was combined into one big wave, it would pummel the beach. But if the energy is spaced out in three separate waves, it's more manageable for the beach to take. Three-phase power can send more electricity to buildings because it spaces out how much power is arriving at a building at any given time, so it doesn't overwhelm the building with more electricity than it can handle. Three-phase can accommodate higher electrical loads. It's great if, say, you need to run freezers and water pumps. But lots of working waterfronts in Maine don't have three-phase power. And this makes transitioning to clean energy solutions a little trickier. It can be easy to assume that Maine's islands and coastal towns are antiquated. In some ways, they are a little stuck in the past, just by virtue of how remote they are and how outdated some of the systems are. And while the solar panels lining the roof of the Islesford Lobster Co-op do come as a surprise, they're indicative of the character of this island and its community. The co-op was started in 1978 when Bruce and other local fishermen came together to purchase the dock.
We bought it, and that was 46 years ago. And it's been running very well ever since. Well, the dock is about 250 feet long. It's got a building on it. We call it bait shed. That's probably almost half the length of the dock. It's got an office building on it, and it's got a container that's a freezer, and we have a cooler on it, and we got fuel pump, and then we have floats with a bridge down to the floats.
Lobster co-ops are a common feature on Maine's working waterfronts. Lobstermen who sell to a co-op agree to have a small percentage of their pay withheld. Here at the Islesford Co-op, that's 80 to 90 cents per pound. And those funds go to maintaining the wharf, paying employees, and paying the bills. And this co-op isn't just a fishing wharf. It also provides services for the island community.
Then we have a store, small store, and we have a fuel containment area and a gas pump on land for, and a diesel pump for island use, land use. We're going to be cooking lobsters and lobster rolls and stuff like that. The restaurant on the island is open for dinner and brunch on Sunday. So we're trying to fill in the blanks with, you know, lunch and all that. So,
co-op is short for cooperative. So the decision to install a solar array was a collective one.
We have a lot of, you know, forward-thinking guys in the co-op. You know, they're not all just looking at the bow of their boat, that, you know,
think about the bigger picture. We had a guy working at the dock, and he was kind of a technical guy. He did a lot with, you know, on internet stuff and that. Plus, he ran the boat and worked on the dock, but he did a lot of that. And then he somehow got associated with the College of the Atlantic about solar. And some students were doing a plan, and this was, I don't know how many years ago it was, 6 or 7 years ago, whatever. And he got talking about it, and then we kind of got talking about it. And then I was reading in an article somewhere online that we can get a grant from the feds for 30%. Or it was 25 or 30%. And so we started putting all this together and say, hey, this is feasible.
That plan from College of the Atlantic was a feasibility study funded by the USDA. In 2019, the co-op was awarded a USDA Rural Energy for America program grant, which covered up to a quarter of the total cost of the solar array. They also received a $4,000 Spark grant from Island Institute.
I think we ended up paying about $130,000 for the whole project, and we got about $35,000 or $6,000 in grants, one from the Island Institute and the other from the feds. And so we borrowed the rest of the money, and we pay the money back by what our average electric bill would be for the whole year. So I don't know where we're at now, but hopefully we're getting down there. So within a few years, it's free electricity.
Solar projects like the Islesford Lobster Co-ops are possible largely because of net metering. The cost of the panels at the co-op, that's about $100,000 total after grants were deducted, is paid off over time by the energy generated by the panels themselves. Without a battery array, the co-op still has an electric bill to pay, since they have no way of storing the extra energy the panels produce during the day. Their freezers and other equipment rely on power from the grid at night and on bad weather days. The excess energy their solar panels produce during the day feeds back into the grid, providing the utility company electricity they did not have to generate themselves and can sell to other customers. In exchange for this excess energy, the owner of the solar panels gets energy credits that lower or entirely pay off their utility bill. The co-op still has to pay off the remainder of the loan they took out for the solar panels, but their utility bills are being subsidized by those panels.
I think especially after it's paid off, we'll get 20 more years of service out of the panels before we have to, I guess we have to replace them, but I mean, 20 years of an average of $12,000 to $15,000 a year in electricity is, you know, that adds up. So,
yes.
Plus we're helping with the environment.
You're listening to Coastal Conversations on WERU at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org. Net metering and interconnectivity, feeding energy back into the grid, have made energy transitions in rural communities economically feasible and possible for individuals and businesses. Here's Jamie Cook, Senior Community Development Officer at the Island Institute, to explain some of the basics.
People find that if they're able to interconnect to their local grid, the economics of doing so are much better. So the solar panel gets energized during the solar day. If there's any energy usage at the house, hopefully. People work from home a lot now, so everything's energized during the day. People are actually home doing things a lot more than they were, say, pre-pandemic. And maybe someone's charging an electric car during the day. It's utilizing that solar energy. And then at night, they utilize the grid for their energy, and the net energy metering process figures out any differential. So if you overproduced your solar during the day and you didn't use all that electricity, then the meter will record that. And through the net energy metering process, the customer will be credited for that overproduction. If they utilize all that energy during the solar day, then that's energy that you're not using from the grid. But there's still this two-way direction of energy flowing between the grid and the home.
This flow of energy from the panels back to the grid is one of the reasons net metering is limited. At this point on Aylesford, there can be no more grid-connected solar projects.
I mean, we got lucky here with our timing that we were able to do what we did, but...
Were you the first on the island?
No, actually, Jason Pickering up the road, he built his house and he did that first. And then the guy who built that place, a big summer home, he put a small one on. And then my neighbor down the road, he did it in that order. He was the third. And then the co-op did it. And then my brother did it. And then that was it. So no more.
If someone wants to get solar panels on Little Cranberry, they would need to invest in the full cost of the panels. They wouldn't be able to pay them off with their monthly electricity bill or offset some of the cost through energy generation. But why is this? Why does the grid max out? Here's Jamie Cook again.
The original electric grid in most regions of the United States, unless it's a brand new subdivision or a brand new mini grid somewhere, were only designed for that electricity to flow in one direction, from centralized power plants across vast transmission lines down to the local utilities and then down to the lower distribution level to homes and businesses. It was only designed for that energy to flow in one direction.
These limitations on the grid mean that the power companies like Versant and Central Maine Power can only take back a certain amount of energy. And this is really frustrating for individuals and businesses in these communities where the grid is maxed out. It can seem really mysterious. Why can my neighbor have interconnected solar, but I can't? One tool that communities can access are connectivity maps. These are online and are provided by some of the utility companies. In the case of Versant, you can look at a map that shows where the hosting capacity is in the red, meaning the grid can't take any more power back. I've included a link to this map in the credits of this episode. On Versant's map, the Cranberry Isles and Mount Desert Island are all completely in the red. So, if your community is in the red, are there ways to change that? For Jamie Cook, those solutions are still sort of aspirational.
A progressive utility, I feel, would get out in front of it and say, yes, we are experiencing challenges integrating solar interconnections in these specific areas. We're doing everything we can at the technical level to address this. Here's a process for getting into a queue or a line to wait for being interconnected. And we may have to engage in what's called interconnection requirement studies. This is nationwide. This is a nationwide trend, and it's not just specific to Maine. And there's specific reasons for these things, and it's not always, quote unquote, the utility's fault. It's a combination of factors that contribute to a certain amount of people having to wait while this utility determines whether or not it's safe for any additional solar systems or distributed energy resources like wind, tidal, or other that can feed into that specific areas. And sometimes it's as simple as upsizing a transformer or upgrading a certain line from a certain point from A to B, or putting in some high-tech equipment at a substation that can monitor the situation.
A community could ask the utility company to do an interconnection requirement study, as Jamie pointed out. That's what would need to happen on Aylesford. But those studies cost money, tens of thousands of dollars, and as of now, that cost would fall to the town or the individuals who are interested in investing in a solar array.
And I think one of the most important things that the PUC...
PUC stands for the Maine Public Utilities Commission.
The Governor's Energy Office, the utilities themselves, nonprofits like the Island Institute, concerned community members can do is work together to create or support the development of a transparent, public, and collaborative process to take a look at these issues.
The Maine Climate Council aims to reduce carbon emissions in the state by 45% by the year 2030. And to achieve that goal, they created the Maine Won't Wait initiatives. This plan outlines actionable strategies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But these transitions away from fossil fuels require investments from the state and communities. It's easy enough to say that we should transition to electric vehicles, but many rural locations can't support EV charging stations. Not yet, anyway. At Island Institute, the push for energy transitions is all tied to coastal infrastructure. Imagining an electrified waterfront, one with electric boats, solar panels, and EV charging stations, requires understanding what we're currently working with on the coast. Island Institute's in the process of analyzing the realities of electric charging access on Maine's waterfronts. Here's Leah Morris, Senior Community Development Officer at Island Institute.
So we're going to have a pretty robust GIS product that comes out of this project that will show people where there currently is level one, level two, and level three access, and or where there is not. And as you can imagine, some of these rural peninsulas will need some increase in power distribution to be able to meet the needs for charging. That's for beneficial electrification, broadly speaking, like solar panels, you name it, not just electric boats. And we hope to come out of that with, here are some hotspots, here are places for opportunity for Island Institute or other interested parties to lean in and provide technical assistance, perhaps financial support to create some of these sort of demonstration hubs, if you want to call it that, where we could really lean in and have a few spots on the coast that really show what beneficial electrification can look like on Maine's working coastline.
Electrification is a key component in transitioning communities away from fossil fuels, and it takes a significant amount of marketing to make it work. Electric boats need to be on the water so that fishermen and sea farmers can see the potential of these vessels firsthand.
About a year's worth of work, we managed to get the first electric commercial work boat that we are aware of in Maine with Pendleton Yacht Yard. It is a 13 plus a little bit foot length rigid inflatable boat with a 40 horsepower electric motor on it that is used in his boatyard service fleet. To a lot of success. It has reduced, obviously, emissions, but less gas consumption, less days off the water for repairs, and great performance. And I think the biggest thing, I mean, as Gabe said, the buzz, I mean, everybody, oh, what's that? Can I come take a ride? So it really has elevated the conversation.
But like with solar expansion, the electric grid is a barrier to this kind of energy transition. And it's important work to try to get these electric motors on the water. There is always some resistance to change, but the events of last winter, multiple increasingly damaging winter storms in January, made climate change and its impacts even more urgent and obvious in many coastal towns and islands.
We've been doing this project this winter with a couple of consultants, Noah Oppenheim and Hattie Train, around shoreside charging infrastructure. Hattie's been doing interviews within the lobster fishery and how quickly this conversation is evolving that, you know, she said 6 months ago doing these interviews, there were people that said, you're nuts to even hybrid electric or electric outboards, you're crazy. And I think perhaps maybe the storms and some other things that have happened here in Maine are starting to make a shift in kind of perception and willing to engage.
Back on Islesford, Bruce Fernald and I make a pit stop at his brother Danny's house. Danny is one of the five households with interconnected solar.
Which you were the last one.
And I shut yeah, it they off. Didn't yeah. say that. They never said anything about, you know, we being the last one that could do it. I question whether that's actually true or not, but that's what they've said.
Danny has something that the Islesford Co-op doesn't. Danny's got a battery. When he worked with the solar company to install his panels, he told them he wanted to be able to have energy even when the power was out. Most interconnected systems only work when connected to the power grid. So if the power goes out because of a storm, The Islesford Co-op does not have electricity.
We told them what we wanted. You know, we told them we wanted a battery, and we told them that we wanted to be able to run off grid and run generator if our battery went dead and it was gray.
Running this system requires a different kind of inverter than the one at the co-op. Customers just need to tell the solar company that you want to be able to store electricity in a battery.
So this is the inverter here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not producing much. Like yesterday in the bright sun, it was almost 10 kilowatt hours. Now it's 2. That's the battery, so it keeps the battery charged at all times.
The extra independence that a battery provides is crucial in this time of increased storms and resulting power outages all over rural Maine. Maybe for small communities like Islesford, the next step in their energy transition is energy independence. The community is at a standstill now on solar projects because of the capacity of the grid, but they could generate and store their own power. This would require an investment, upgrading inverters and buying batteries, but would enable access to electricity in the event of another significant storm.
This was all clean before the storms, and there's a big log in there. We've dragged a lot of logs out of here that washed up over the beach into here. They couldn't get down here. This water, 2 feet deep, all in through here.
Oh my gosh. But all this is storm debris.
Yeah, all this is storm debris. It was all... This all tore up. And this is where the last telephone pole down there is where our cable comes across. And right now, if we had an issue with it, we couldn't get there. Now, when the storm happened, this was 8 feet deep and 15 feet wide. And now it floods. There's enough filled back in on its own. But still, when the tide's real high, it floods all the way up.
The impact of January's storms to Maine's coastline reveal even more challenges in energy transitions and innovation on the state's working waterfront. As is the case with the Islesford Lobster Co-op, the ideal place for investment and infrastructure is at the water's edge. That also happens to be the most vulnerable location in a storm. Suddenly, putting a solar array on the roof of a building, on a wharf that juts into the ocean, feels a little more precarious after watching other wharves disappear into the sea.
I've been kind of thinking about it and talking about it with some different people, just thinking, what do we do since we can't insure the dock? Well, if we have a really bad storm, we lose everything? Jeez, I mean, that's a lot of money sitting there. And we do own the land behind the store all the way up to the road. Oh, a certain line from here towards that brownish house there. So we have room to put them there, and we just gotta think what we want to do. I don't know what's going to happen. If we had we can't get insurance on the dock unless we want to pay like $100,000 a year, because nobody's insuring places over the water anymore unless you're going to pay through the nose for it.
Bruce has considered taking the panels off the co-op bait shed and moving them to dry land. But again, improvements like this cost money, and the dock looks strong. It's held up in the storms so far.
So we'll just sort of keep our fingers crossed that the dock will stay in place.
Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations. This episode was produced by Galen Koch, with support from Olivia Jolly and Keegan Clonch. From the Sea Up is made possible by the Fund for Maine Islands through a partnership between Island Institute, College of the Atlantic, Maine Sea Grant, and the First Coast. Join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you're hearing in the background is called A Following Sea, and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. On behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with Skudik Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend and a very happy new year.